And that majestic sound means it's time for our Majestic History Matters segment, taking a look back at this week in history with the one and only Scott Washington, historian extraordinaire, who joins us here in the studio. How are you?
Well, doing good, Aaron. How about yourself?
I'm doing great.
Yes.
I'm getting close to the end of the week.
That's right.
I've got no weekend plans whatsoever, so
excellent.
It'll be a nice take-it-easy kind of thing.
Well, that seems so appropriate because this week also marks International Cat Day.
Yeah,
so
we were celebrating that.
Your cats will be very happy to hear that.
I mean, every day is International Cat Day.
The way they look so... Isn't it time to celebrate me?
Yeah, by giving me the food that you should have given me hours and hours ago.
I just think it's great that there is such creativity involved in marking milestones of our life. Not only birthdays and anniversaries, but things like these goofy things like International Cat Day.
It's just fascinating just how many of those there are.
That's right.
There are like every single day of the year, it's like 10 different, it's National Lobster Tossing Day or something.
But when it says international, like do cats meow in different languages? Like, I don't understand what that is.
I think they may actually. I don't know. But I mean, dogs will I can't. I can't speak for cats. I know that our cats at home, they kind of understand their own name, and they understand banjo sticks. Who wants food for cats? Because that's when they take off going upstairs. But beyond that, they don't know a whole lot. Dogs will understand, I think, a few more commands, but different countries, different languages.
Yeah.
So they may not be able to speak a different language, but they'll understand different
languages.
And we
thought music was the international language. Oh, but here is something, speaking of international, that started in, it's August 10th, 1889. A fellow was born, Charles Darrow. And
yes.
This is a fellow who invents the game Monopoly in 1933. He became a millionaire, published in 23 languages in a Braille version. So
wow.
Talk about international language.
Not to mention all of the UNC-opolies.
Right,
and
exactly.
Pittsburgh-opolies. Because they've got it for like individual universities
yeah.
and cities and everything
That's
like
right.
that. Yeah.
And how much that makes a difference. Well, there are also some other inventions this week I just think that are just kind of fun. Well, a big one is 1981, when IBM introduces their IBM personal computer, which starts the PC revolution
nice,
in a big
yeah.
way. And of course, this is on August 11th, which is also the birthday of Steve Wozniak, who is the fellow, of course, who really invents the Apple computer.
That must have been a great birthday in 1981.
When shall we introduce it? Let's do it on this day.
Well, no, because like IBM and Apple were rivals at the time,
That's
weren't
right.
they?
So
Steve Wozniak is sitting there on his 31st birthday shaking his fist and going, IBM,
right.
we'll get you one day.
One day. That's it. There were some other funny ones this week. Well, I mean, this is kind of a monumental one. Here we are on the radio. The first voice recording was by Thomas Edison recording his recitation of Mary Had a Little Lamb in 1877.
Yeah. Thus starting the precedent
That's right.
of having this great medium that you can use and just completely wasting it. Like, he could have said anything at all.
That's right.
He could have said one small step for man, one giant
right.
leap for mankind. Nope, Mary
had
a little lamb. That's what we're going
lamb.
With.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Do better next time, Edison, when this rolls around again in 8 quadrillion years.
That's right. Well, there's another one. There's a couple of funny ones. Now, this is famous last words. Now, this is a little macabre, but there was a fellow in 1966. His name was James French. He was on death row. And he was being executed by electric chair for murdering his cellmate. But he thought it was funny, and he thought, wouldn't the title be tomorrow's headline, French Fries? Which is terrible. It's macabre humor, but candid camera debuts on that day, too.
That was a really whiplash segue there.
Well, we live in the age of... I don't know.
I'm just like
today.
Doing donuts in the parking lot to get to that one.
Now, here's one, and I just had to say, well, I didn't have a chance to check this. The $2 bill, and we all remember it. I have a date of 1966. I'm not sure that was 1996. U.S. Treasury Department discontinues printing the bill due to a lack
of I'm looking this up because I think it's I think it's more maybe they stopped it and picked it up again because I think don't bills only exist in circulation for maybe a couple of years before they get kind of worn out and replaced, but there's still $2 bills
around. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Okay. Okay, so if Wikipedia is to be trusted, so we're not not necessarily taking this without a grain of salt, years of printing 1862 to 1966 and then picked back up again in 1976.
Oh, okay.
So there was
All right.
10-year period.
All right. So there was.
When
so,
they gave
okay.
up on the $2 bill.
So I was not mistaken.
Yes,
I was thinking,
yes.
Wow, my memory is really sharp from the 1960s when I was a kid, or not. Well, okay, that's good to know. Thank you for clarifying that.
This what happened in 1976 that they were like, we need the $2 bill back?
You know, it was the bicentennial year.
Oh,
so I'm thinking
you're
that's
right.
Where they said, oh, let's bring this back.
You are right.
And the thing is that and also, of course, the dollar coin have had a hard time picking up traction because the Susan B. Anthony coin, because there wasn't any room in the registers, the tills.
Mm-hmm.
So when people went to cash it, it's like, well, where are we going to put this?
Oh, yeah.
It always got tossed to the back. And
right, and forgotten about.
Yeah.
Well, people need to get used to it, too, because I know, I mean, I'm sure, not that the dollar coin is that common, but we've
right.
all had the experience of having one and then going
yeah.
out and spending it. You get them confused with quarters so easily, right? And
like, right, exactly. Well, and that's appropriate because this is the week when Congress actually authorized coinage to be established. And now, what most people don't know is that that was in 1786, August 8th, 1786. Mm-hmm. And what most people don't know is the first U.S. dollar wasn't printed until 1862. And we think, wow, but it didn't bear the image of George Washington. It bore the image of Salmon Chase, President Lincoln's Secretary of Treasury.
All right. I mean, that's definitely a Civil War thing, right?
Yes.
I mean, they needed to print money in order to fund
yeah,
the war.
Yeah, but that's, money makes a difference, as we all know, and how history happens as well.
So no greenbacks at all until 1862 then. Was it all coins then? I mean, I know paper money
was...
No,
there was paper money. There was. In fact, I remember in Hillsborough seeing a copy of a draft for a property deed, and it had shillings. So apparently...
Oh, interesting.
This is the early 19th century.
Yeah, yeah.
I did a double take. Shillings, I said, they're still using... some kind of different printed currency, I guess, was maybe wasn't entirely standardized. Or
probably
the
not. Well, I mean, printed, like, paper money was controversial, right, in the 18th century and on into the 19th century because, like, it's paper. It doesn't actually mean anything just in and of itself. It's a reference to some other money that exists kind of in Fort Knox somewhere. And we have to kind of get it into our heads that this equals that, but that takes time.
It takes some time. And there's another fellow.
It's my rudimentary understanding of economics, y'all.
That's right. There's another
probably
person.
Probably got all of that wrong. money and the things over there.
Well, this
and
is to get people to
that.
Go, hey, I want to go to the computer. I want to look this up,
You
too.
Want to look this
yeah,
up, yeah.
Get curious.
Yeah.
August 8th, 1740, another person is born, Abner Nash. And I want to bring it up because there is actually a North Carolina, in fact, a Hillsborough connection. Abner and his brother Francis came to Hillsborough, and they began to trade. They got involved in politics. Francis Nash would become this brother who becomes a general who helps defend Washington's retreat at Germantown, gets mortally wounded, and a large monument is dedicated to him.
Mm-hmm.
But Abner becomes actually a governor here in North Carolina. And by June of 1781, he's done. He doesn't want to do it. And then the other governor that's in Hillsborough comes to the fore, who is later kidnapped by the British. So it's really interesting to see that all this history, we come up with certain things that have a Carolina connection. That makes a
very cool
a difference. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm speaking with Scott Washington, History Matters, for those of you just joining us. I got to mention, since we still have some time, we want to talk about this. Today in history, August 9th, what year was this? 74 was the resignation of Richard Nixon.
Yes. What a good president.
44 years ago, yeah.
That can happen. Presidents can resign, yes. And that saved the country from a prolonged impeachment and removal due to the Watergate scandal.
It is interesting. I'm reading this book, and I've got it sitting over there because I was taking notes on it earlier today. It's a book by Charles Lewis, who's a journalist, I think Center for Public Integrity now is what he works for. But it's a book called 935 Lies, which is a reference to the 935 lies combined that were uttered in public by various members of the George W. Bush administration in the run-up to the war with Iraq. But that's the reference to the title. But the book is all about, like, the extent to which people in power, whether it's government officials or CEOs of corporations, he talks about big tobacco and things like that, will just straight up tell lies or withhold significant information from the public in order to justify their actions or hang on to power. And the role of the media in terms of shedding daylight on that and revealing that information and holding those officials accountable for what they do. And this is something that's becoming more and more difficult for a variety of different reasons, which he talks about in the book. But he talks about this period from like the mid-60s through the mid-70s, where not only do you have Watergate, you also have all of the kind of deceptive and straight up misleading and incorrect on purpose lies about the Vietnam War to justify what the country was doing. I can imagine in the middle of the 1970s, after 10 plus years of just nonstop deception and misleading and being lied to and being misled and having information withheld, just how low an opinion Americans must have had of the government after 10 years of that. And that's both parties. That's Nixon, that's Johnson, that's McNamara, who kind of crosses party lines, Kissinger, who crosses party lines. Yeah.
Well, and it could be that's why Carter had some advantage in the 76 election for those years, because somebody wanted somebody who was refreshingly candid about what was going on. But it's interesting you mentioned about George W. Bush, because in 2001, August 6th is when there is the White House briefing, and it only went to a very select people, titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. And later on, of course, Bush and other folks would say, oh, well, we just thought that was historical. But there is a certain kind of looming prophetic quality to that, unfortunately, as well. Now, also, just on this is on the more serious side, August 6th and August 9th is when we also had two atom bombs used on cities, and this was in 1945, after many, many years of war and the death of millions of people. That's when the first atomic bomb was used in 1945 on August 6th with Hiroshima, which killed 100,000 people, and then August 9th in Nagasaki, which killed 70,000. And we should at least be cognizant of these dates in a somber way. To say that, yes, nuclear weapons are still part of our world, and we don't want them either in the wrong hands or to be used cavalierly as a tool. So that's part of history, too, is not only development of technology, like the Singer sewing machine we all have heard about. There was a fellow named Isaac Singer, August 12th, 1852, who received a patent for his continuous stitch sewing machine. Now, I'm not putting him in the category of the atom bomb.
I was going to say, that's another 90 degree.
But to say that there are all different kinds of ways that we use creativity, and sometimes it's for ends that continue to benefit, and sometimes they're more ones that should make us all ponder.
This actually is a significant week for inventions, because you mentioned Isaac Singer and the sewing machine. Alexander Fleming is born this week in history. This is the guy who discovers penicillin. And of course, the birthday of Frank Epperson on August 11th, who invented the popsicle.
And wanted to call it the epicycle or
and
something.
And that is how you complete the 90 degree turn.
I think this has been a good way that history is looked at, and it keeps you going all different directions, going, what did we just see? Well, that's what's what happens. And there's also one other one, the woman who wrote the Dick and Jane stories.
Oh, yeah. Born this week.
Was born this week. And, her name was Zena or let's say, no, Zerna Addis Sharp, born in 1889. She creates the Dick and Jane readers. We've all seen these. Also, this was on, August 12th, 1859, 30 years earlier, Catherine Lee Bates is born, who wrote the words to the national hymn, America the Beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then in 1925, Norris McWhirter, who with his twin brother Norris creates the Guinness Book of World Records.
Wait, were they both named Norris?
Let's see. No, that can't be.
Stranger okay, things is, have happened than
this
that.
This is one, obviously. I did not look up Norris and Norris. Well, maybe not. But this will give something for our listeners to do to say, what were the name of those
folks? No, I'm looking that one up
okay,
right now.
Good, because that would leave us in a... in a doozy of a fix.
All right. Speaking with Scott Washington, Norris and Ross McWhirter.
Ah, well, thank you.
Also, according to Wikipedia, so take it with a grain of salt. Stranger things have happened than two brothers both being named Norris.
Believe it or not.
Or not. Hey. All right. We got time for one more. What do you
okay.
got?
Okay. 1888, the revolving door is patented by Theophilus Van Cannel. Now, can you imagine?
Norris McWhirter is not a bad enough name. Theophilus Van Cannel?
Yes, that's right. And you think, how did this use come about? If only I didn't have to go and push the door open.
With a name like that, you're going to be an inventor.
Yeah, that's right. I guess they got tired of the cold air coming in, and they said, all right, let's see if we can do something about it. But I think that's kind of an unusual one. Also in 1794, Whiskey Rebellion. President Washington orders the rebellion Western Pennsylvania farmers to go home and calls for 15,000 militia. They were protesting an excise duty placed on stills and spirits distilled in the U.S. Herman Husband, who was part of the Regulator Rebellion from Hillsborough, actually is arrested and he dies in jail later on. Just
rabble rouser all his life.
Rabble rouser, yes, exactly.
There you go.
All right. I'll drink to that.
And that is This Week in History with Scott Washington. As always, thank you so much.
We have covered the waterfront today.